This episode of The Incubator is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Do you find yourself juggling multiple websites and clinical tools as you care for your patients? NeoCarePal is a resource providing access to multiple clinical calculators in just one place. To learn more, visit NICUconnections.com/NeoCarePal.
This is The Incubator, a weekly discussion about new advances in neonatology and the fascinating individuals who make this progress possible. I am Dr. Ben Korsha.
And I'm Dr. Daphne Yasova Barbeau. We are neonatal intensive care physicians.
Welcome. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Incubator Podcast. We are back today with a new episode from our series, The Giants of Neonatology. We have the pleasure of having on with us Professor Ola Søgstad from Norway. Daphne, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. We love the Giants series, and we certainly have a giant in the studio with us today, don't we?
Absolutely. Dr. Søgstad, thank you so much for making the time to be on with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor and a pleasure to be here as your guest.
The pleasure is all ours. I'm going to introduce I could spend the hour reading your bio. So I'm going to try to give a cursory version of your bio so that people can actually get a glimpse as to the work that you've done and the impact that you've had on the field. You earned your medical degree in 1973 and your PhD in 1977 from the University of Oslo. And you went in 1980 to get your postdoc with a Fogarty grant from the National Institutes of Health at Division of Neonatology Department of Pediatrics in the University of California in San Diego. You have done tremendous work when it comes to neonatal resuscitation. Your research in Sweden and Oslo has really changed the concept that newborn need resuscitation at birth with pure oxygen. And maybe you've allowed this transition to happen where we actually perform neonatal resuscitation with much less oxygen and more closer to room air. You have traveled all over the world. You've given lectures about newborn resuscitation and health. You've been given numerous international and national awards, such as the Landmark Award by the American Academy of Pediatrics. You're an appointed honorary member of a number of national associations and an honorary doctor and professor of international institutions. Dr. Søgstad, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning. I wanted to begin this conversation by talking about the early stages of your life. You grew up in a very academic environment. Your father was a psychologist. Your mother was in education. Can you tell us a little bit what it was like to grow up in this environment?
Well, I think it was basically very stimulating. But you know, when I was a boy, I didn't think about it. But I have to mention also that which you didn't mention, I spent 2 years in Chicago when I was a small boy. From 3 to 5 years, because my father took his PhD. Yeah, so my father took his PhD in psychology.
Did that have any remaining lasting impact on you?
Yeah, I think so. Because I always felt I had a very close relation emotionally to the United States. And of course, at that time, although I was only 5 years, I spoke fluent American. And then I forgot it. But I always felt kind of U.S. is my second home country. And but of course, when I grew older, I realized I was brought up in perhaps a special family. My father was a professor. I had two uncles who were professors. And my grandfather was professor and director of the University of Oslo. And if you go back in my, especially on my mother's family, there are academicians and priests for 200 years. So, of course, when I now when I'm older, I can't appreciate that background more and understand it was mm-hmm. a privilege to be raised in such an environment.
Considering the quality of the work that your parents have accomplished, did they look down on your decision to pursue a career in medicine?
Well, no. I was very determined. From I was 12 years old, I decided I want to be a doctor.
Mm.
And there was no discussion about it. And one of my privileges was that I learned very early in life that you should follow your calling, your interests. And if the young people come up to me and ask for advice, I say the same. Follow your interest. And I think that's the most important.
Was there an experience that prompted you at the age of 12 to fall in love with healthcare, with medicine?
I don't think there was anything special. I wanted to become an archaeologist, for a very brief period of my life. But then I decided to become a doctor. So I don't know. I had two uncles who are doctors. So, but I found I was interested in humans, but I was also interested in science. So I found this was a kind of a unique combination, medicine. And at that time, I was not thinking about,
I was wondering, a lot of us in medicine, we have children, right? And we talk a lot about are our kids going to go into medicine, or how do we balance, wanting our kids to be successful, but not too much pressure? That's a big conversation, I think, for parents these days. And it sounds like you had quite a supportive family despite this kind of academic pedigree. And so I wonder if there were any particular things that were really supportive in your childhood, your kind of young adulthood, adolescence, that helped kind of set you on this path. I think one that was quite academically rigorous, but I think in terms of science and thinking of new solutions, we really have to foster this kind of creativity in our rising scientists so that their minds stay open to new opportunities.
Nobody really questioned my wish to become a doctor when I grew up because I didn't discuss it with anyone. I just decided I want to do that. I changed when I went into high school. I changed school to get, because it was very competitive to get into medical school in Oslo. So I had from early in high school, I had to really get good grades. And so I changed school and I was very determined. But I had another interest, which was as strong as my interest for medicine. That was soccer. I was a passionate soccer player from I was 8, 9 years old, and I was very ambitious. So I tried to combine that with medical students and studies, and So I had two passions.
I'll have more questions about your perspective on football afterwards, because as a Frenchman myself, okay. I cannot say soccer. I'm so sorry. We'll have to stick with football. But why neonatology then? I was looking at your family history, and I thought for sure psychiatry was in line for you with a family dedicated to education and a father who was a prominent psychologist. At what point do you say, I want to treat children, I want to help kids and babies?
Well, that was during my medical studies, medical school, because I was extremely interested in biochemistry, for instance. And I also, from I was young, I've written about that in my biography. Well, I always felt I got contact with children. I felt that children need protection. And then I found this unique combination of children and biochemistry in pediatrics. And I didn't have any clear vision or wish to go into neonatology, but I just by my chance, I would say, I got this offer at my last year in medical school in Oslo to go to Sweden and start research on perinatal asphyxia with with the famous professor of perinatal medicine, Gösta Roth. So that was serendipitous, I think. But then I decided this is what I want to do. And I want to dedicate my life, at least my professional life, to newborns.
Your research work is obviously something that we wanted to talk to you about. You have truly made an impact on how we resuscitate babies at birth by moving us away from using 100% oxygen on babies who were suffering from asphyxia, hypoxemia. I think there's an interesting story between neonatology and oxygen. I think we used to love oxygen, then we learned to hate oxygen, then we sort of recently have come to this sort of middle ground or this marital status where we're like, we understand that too much is probably not good and not enough is probably not as good either. Can you tell us a little bit when you're embarking on this work, looking at oxidative stress and so on? Is that something that is in vogue? Is that something that's the trend at the time to try to really look at the effects of oxygen? Or are you feeling like you're taking an unusual path in neonatal research?
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, the history of oxygen in neonatology is fascinating and quite dramatic, as you know. And I was not interested in oxygen per se when I started my research. I was interested in asphyxia, and the aim of my doctoral thesis, which I started in Sweden in Uppsala, was to find the biochemical indicator of asphyxia. And at that time, we had APGA score, and we had acid-base balance, but not more than that. So my supervisor, he had very high ambitions, and I was just finished medical school, but he had high ambitions. Said, "Ola, you have to kind of invent or find a biochemical APGA score." So I embarked on that, and I started to measure this metabolite, which is called hypoxanthin. And hypoxanthin is a purine metabolite. It's a breakdown product from ATP. So I was thinking that if we can measure hypoxanthin in body fluids, you kind of get an estimation of the energy status of the cell, because you know the ATP is intracellularly, so we cannot measure that in body fluids. So I thought that maybe hypoxanthin kind of could reflect the ATP level. Now, the problem was that there was no methods to measure hypoxanthin at that time in body fluids. So my supervisor, who was an expert on PO2 electrodes, and he suggested that we should measure the oxygen consumption when hypoxanthin is oxidized to uric acid in the presence of the enzyme xanthin oxidase. So I started to work on that, and I was able to actually establish this method to measure hypoxanthin in plasma of newborn babies. And I needed only 0.2 milliliter of plasma, and I was able to measure this very fast. So that was the starting point, and then I started to measure hypoxanthin in an umbilical cord of newborn babies who had suffered asphyxia compared with controls, non-asphyxic babies, and found that asphyxic babies had significantly higher, actually almost fivefold higher, hypoxanthin levels. So that was the start, and that was my starting point to work with asphyxia and to find an indicator biochemical indicator of asphyxia.
I think it's such a good reminder of how far neonatology has come. I mean, really what you were doing, and the fact that you mentioned it was 0.2 mLs, right? We're so judicious about how much blood we take from babies, but this was really a time where, I mean, frequent labs were not a part of the routine management. We just didn't, you know, have those opportunities. Mm. So it's just so interesting that that's, you know, how your career started. I wonder if you can speak a little bit then to how did you get more involved with the resuscitation side of things?
Yes. Yeah. So I went back to Oslo, and I wanted to kind of pursue this, follow up this observation about hypersantin. So I got the position as a research fellow at the Institute for Surgical Research at the University of Oslo. And there I started to experimental studies. So I measured hypersantin in animals, for instance, pigs, piglets, during hypoxia, and was able to show that hypersantin is increased. And then we did a study, which was, for me, very important. We measured hypersantin during resuscitation of, we had animals with endotoxic shock, and we resuscitated them. And we are actually measuring something completely different. We are measuring proteolytic enzymes. So this was a colleague of mine, but I was helping him, and I said, do you mind if we resuscitate the animals at the end of the experiments, and I take some blood and measure hypersantin? And we did, and what I saw was that hypersantin increases exponentially during resuscitation, the first 10-12 minutes. Very rapid increase in hypersantin. At the same time, I read a paper of Friedovich and McCord from the U.S. Showing that santin is an oxygen radical generator. When santin is oxidized to uric acid, oxygen radicals are generated. And hypersantin is the step for santin. So then I, of course, it was quite easy to understand that if hypersantin is oxidized to uric acid, it generates free radicals. And of course, if you have a very high hypersantin concentration in the body, your body fluids or in the tissues, and you then give oxygen, then I understood that this might be detrimental, because the more hypersantin you have, the more free radicals will be generated. So we published this in 1979, and in 1980, I suggested this in another study. So that was kind of the first time we suggested that the combination of hypersantin and oxygen might be detrimental.
Now, I was going to disagree with you, because it doesn't seem that straightforward. I think the connections you were...
It doesn't seem easy at all.
But because I think what you're describing...
I have to tell you, I had studied some biochemistry mm-hmm. in addition to medical school. So maybe it was easier for me to grasp this.
Because I think that's interesting that you're looking for this marker of hypoxia. But then to make the connection that this element, the hypoxanthine, could actually be a source of oxygen radicals. And to be clear, you're talking about the hypoxanthine-xanthine oxidase system. I think it doesn't feel like it would be logical for the marker of hypoxia to then be able to generate this amount of radicals. So I think it's quite impressive that you were able to see this connection between the two. But I wanted to let you finish maybe once you realize that hypoxanthine is a marker of hypoxia, but that there's this explosive generation, as you mentioned, of oxygen radicals by the in the post-hypoxic reoxygenation phase. When exactly do you make that connection, and when do you clearly see, hey, we need to use then less oxygen at resuscitation?
So this was in 1980. I started my research. I finished medical school in 1973, so this took 7 years. But in between, I had to do my internship, and I started my specialization in pediatrics in 1979. So I was not so active in experimental research for some years, but I had this in the back of my head during these years. And then I was able to get grants from the end of the 80s, 87, 86, 87. I got my first grants. I got my PhD fellows. So I recruited two or three PhD fellows, and I was interested in test out the effect of hypoxanthin on the circulation. I have to mention, I spent also a semester in San Francisco at the Institute for Cardiovascular Research in 1986. And so I became interested in the perinatal circulation and regulation of the perinatal circulation. I was with the now late Abraham Rudolph, who was an extraordinary man. So then we started to do, again, some animal experiments with pigs and then piglets, and they were not so successful. So I had this in the back of my head that perhaps one should resuscitate with lower oxygen concentrations, but I had not really, I was not so determined that I should test it out. But then one of my fellows, he had problems with his experiments. We didn't get good results. And then I suggested, well, why not we try to see if we can resuscitate with air? And he did. And it was, it went very well. So we looked at hemodynamic markers and acid-base balance, and they did as well with air as with 100% oxygen. And this was the end of the 80s. So in 1991, we published or we presented our first results with newborn piglets resuscitated with air versus 100% oxygen. And I still remember this was my fellow presented that at the European Society for Pediatric Research. It was in Zurich in Switzerland, and it was a packed, auditorium. And I never forget the reaction, because it was, people were so enthusiastic when we presented that. I think people understood that this was a kind of a change in the paradigm. So we were able to show that it is possible to resuscitate with air. And then we went on, and I realized I had to do some clinical studies. And how could I do that? I talked to my old boss in Sweden, Gösta Roth, and I said, we have to do clinical studies also. And I didn't have any experience with clinical studies at that time. I'd done a lot of animal experiments, but no clinical studies. So he said, well, I was in contact with a guy in New Delhi in India, Siddharth Ramji, and he is running a big unit in Delhi. So maybe we can ask him if he want to join us, make a project. So we did. I wrote up a protocol, and Siddharth said, yes, he would like to do that. And very quickly, he had resuscitated 84 newborn babies with either air or 100% oxygen. And again, we were able to show that outcome was more or less similar between these groups. And we published that. Again, we went to the European Society of Pediatric Research. That was in 1992 now. It was in Sweden. And again, there was a very, very positive reaction from the audience. And we published that in those data in 1993 in Pediatric Research. And then I was thinking, well, this was only a pilot study. We need a bigger study. So then I started to organize what is called the RESER 2 study, which was a multicenter study. We recruited 10 centers from six different countries, from India, Philippines, Egypt, Spain, Estonia, Norway, and we got approximately 600 babies who needed resuscitation. And again, we were able to show that those babies who had been resuscitated with air did as well as those who had received 100% oxygen. And there was a tendency to better outcome in the air resuscitated babies, but it was not significant. And now, and this was published in 1998. And then several other started to test this out. For instance, Max Wento from Valencia. Well, he did some big studies and did more studies in India. So, around 2003, 2004, I had sabbatical. I spent that in Spain with Max Wento, and we wrote up a meta-analysis. And then we were able to show that the mortality was lower in babies resuscitated with air. And that was, for me, also a surprise, because I hadn't expected that. I thought that maybe we can show that you can do as well with air as with 100% oxygen. But now we show that there was a 30% reduction in mortality. So that was really a surprise. And now we are, and then the first Cochrane review came also in 2004, showing the same.
There's actually a very nice article by Max Wento in Neo Reviews, in a historical perspective, that talks a little bit about this journey that you embarked on. In there, he mentions that the response to the initial results was not always very positive. He even mentions that in 1997, when you were giving a lecture at the European Society for Pediatric Research in Hungary, somebody like stood up and shouted at you because they were not particularly negative. Can you tell us a little bit about what was it like dealing with a portion of the community not thinking that this was the right path for neonatology?
Well, many people said I was crazy. And I remember this woman. I had the honor to give the opening lecture of this European Congress in Hungary. And she stood up and shouted at me that it was unethical. And my answer was, but it's, you know, use oxygen has never been tested out in a randomized study before. So that is, if it's unethical, that is also unethical. So I got some such reactions, but mostly people said this was a stupid idea or I was crazy. But then we got more and more results, and I think people changed their attitude. So in 2000, I was invited to be part of the panel making the new international guidelines, the ILCOR guidelines. And we met in Dallas, and at that time, I didn't feel we had enough data to say that you should start with air. But it was said that if you don't have oxygen, you may start with air, which I think was a progress. And then in 2005, 2006, new ILCOR guidelines were published, and they said that you can choose whether you would use 100% oxygen or air. And then some countries quickly changed their national guidelines. And the first country which changed was Canada. I was in Canada in 2006. I gave a lecture at a national meeting. And then I went to Australia some months later, and Australia changed also. So these were the two first countries who changed from oxygen to air. And many other countries, including my own, were hesitating. And some said maybe we should pick something in between 40%. But, you know, we hadn't tested out 40%. We hadn't tested out 60%. But then more and more countries changed, and actually U.S. was one of the last countries to change, not because people were not interested, because many people were interested. I got a lot of support, a lot of interest. I was invited to the United States. I think it was for legal reasons. People didn't dare to do changes and to deviate from what was considered as the standard practice of care. So, but then more and more, you know, I think centers also in U.S. switched to AIR. And in 2010, ILCOR changed and said that you should start with AIR for babies, only babies, term or near-term babies. We hadn't really tested this out in preterm babies.
It's a long history, and I really valued you walking us through that. You're right. In the 2010, they said we can start with room air, but it was actually not until 2015 where they recommended, ILCOR recommended against hyperoxia, starting, you know, with 65 to 100%. You know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast and how long it takes from, you know, the initial studies that show benefit to getting things to the bedside. This was a perfect example of that. And I wonder, what are some of your recommendations? How can we shorten the lead time I respect that everybody wanted to make sure that you were right, obviously. But what do you think is some of the tips to shortening the time from, bench studies to clinical studies and then being able to get things to the patients?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Reckitt Mead Johnson. Reckitt Mead Johnson is dedicated to the research and development of nutrition products that help support baby development at every stage, including an extensive Enfamil portfolio for premature and low birth weight infants. To learn more, visit hcp.meadjohnson.com.
Well, often was told that, Ola, you have to be more aggressive. You have to promote this. But, you know, I didn't feel it was my role to promote room air resuscitation. My role was to present data. And I think that those who present data should not be the same making the changes. Because, that was very important for me. And then I was also thinking during these 30 years, because it took 30 years to change, that, well, maybe something is wrong with my reasoning here, maybe. And it could be subgroups of babies who need oxygen. So I was not so keen to stand up and say that we have to change. I kind of appreciate it took time and that there was more and more new other studies confirming what we found also. But, of course, 30 years was too much. And I think we had evidence 10 years earlier or close to 10 years earlier.
I was just going to say, we just reviewed a paper this last week on our journal club about the use of hyperoxia in babies undergoing therapeutic hypothermia with HIE. And, you know, we're still learning about how potentially detrimental, free radicals can be. But as Ben mentioned, this was kind of revolutionary at the time that you were studying it, not just in neonatology, but across medicine. And you actually, you wrote a book, The War Over Oxygen. And it says here, you describe it as one of the greatest scandals in the history of medicine. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because, there was a dogma. It was a dogma from the end of the 18th century. You know, oxygen was described as an element in 1792 or from Sweden or 1794 by Priestley. And very, very quickly, they started to use oxygen, treat newborn babies with oxygen, and was not much questioning about using 100% oxygen. Well, Michael Obladen, the German neonatologist, he has summarized the history of that and said that for 200 years, there was no one really questioning the use of 100% oxygen. And American Heart Association, in their guideline for newborn resuscitation in 1992, said that there is no reason to be concerned giving 100% oxygen during the very brief period of newborn resuscitation. So that was in 1992. However, in 1998, I was invited to the Heart Topics in Washington for the first time and presented my data. I was very nervous because I knew that there were many critical persons in the audience and, you know, all the kind of elite of American neonatologists were there. So, but I gave my lecture, and there was a long, I've written about that in my book, but there's a long line, people coming up to, queuing up for, to the microphone, but Mary Ellen Avery stood up, and she supported me. And she said, I've always been concerned about using 100% oxygen. And that was so important. I got support from the queen of neonatology at that time, Mary Ellen Avery. I will never forget that. And we became good friends till she died some years ago now.
That's so interesting how maybe sometimes when we have the incentive to speak up, this can have a big impact. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Did any of the naysayers who didn't think that room air resuscitation was a good idea eventually turn around and came to apologize to say, hey, we were wrong. Sorry for making your life difficult.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. But, you know, when it changed, mm-hmm. it changed quickly. Mm-hmm. And I felt really I was kind of a celebrity very quickly. And I came to Australia in 2007 and I was cheered as a champion, you know. So I cannot complain. I think that it is important that you also people have criticism and objections to new ideas. So, then I was fortunate because you mentioned Max Vento, and of course he was a very, very important part of this because he so quickly started to study the same So we have been very close collaborators and friends for more than 30 years now.
I think yours is one really of the perseverance needed for science. And I wonder, you know, there's so many things in neonatology specifically that we take as dogma. We've used that word a few times. And I wonder, how do we not make kind of some of these same mistakes when we have somebody in the community who wants to revisit old practices, you know, and say, well, we haven't thought about it from this side before. How do we promote people looking at practices that haven't been well studied in neonatology?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have to be open to new ideas. And I think that if you want to say that you want to change practice or you think you question established routines, you have to study it in a proper way by randomized studies and pilot studies, animal studies first if possible, which I think is what we want to do, and then to do it in a proper way and do randomized studies and multi-center studies. I think that's the only way to do that.
Ola, we had the pleasure of having at the Delphi conference this year, Professor Atli Mohan, who you know very well, who spoke to us a little bit about how the field of neonatology has reached the era of complexity. And I am wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about how challenging it is becoming to continue to do these randomized control trials, as we're just bringing up, in the current climate where there are so many variables, the patients are so complex, there's a lot of differences between babies of various gestational ages. How do you feel that research and investigative work in neonatology has changed, and where do you see it go in the next 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, well, that's a very big question, of course, and I think Atle Moen, who was one of my first PhD fellows, is a better man to answer these questions. But I think that, you know, yeah, it's true, you have so many complex situations, and again, I think that you have to make very strict and protocols, and but of course it's more complex now than when I started my clinical studies 30 years ago or more than 30 years ago. But I think the basis is the same, that you have to, when you do randomized studies, and you have to be sure that you have enough power. I've seen so many studies, also animal studies, which do not have power. And then I think it's a waste of time and money, and it is unethical to do that, because if you do a study and you can't get an answer from that study, it's a waste of time and money and resources. So that's one thing. It has to be done in a decent way. And I'm now, the last years I've been part of a large international group. We are kind of pursuing this, all these questions about oxygen, because there are lots of unanswered questions. And I think in this group with international experts, I think also that's one way to collaborate, because we are kind of discussing together, and first of all, we have to identify weaknesses of our own protocols. And again, we have to do it in a proper way, that we have sufficient power. And of course, we have to adjust our confounding factors and all these things.
I think what I'm gathering from your answer is that complexity should not deter us from continuing to strive for the type of rigorousness that that we've always aimed to achieve in clinical and basic science research. So I think I was talking to people that have worked with you in the past, and they mentioned a few things, like you set the bar very high, you're very competitive. So I'm not very surprised by the answer that you've given us about complexity, which leads me to my last question. I'll let Daphna close out the show afterwards. But speaking to people who have worked with you, they mentioned a few themes that I think relate to something you spoke to us about earlier in the episode, where you talked to us about your passion for football. I think people who've worked with you said that you're very competitive, and that they always feel like they're part of the team. They always feel like they're part of a larger body, a group of people. Do you draw a lot from the themes of soccer, football, to and how you manage a research group or a research team, and can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think we can learn a lot from team sport, soccer, football, European football, because you have to be a team, and you have to accept that your teammates do mistakes, but you also have to accept that you do mistakes yourself. And then, of course, if you are a good team, you see that you achieve so much more than if you are kind of trying to do everything alone. And actually, when I became a professor, I became head of the Department of Pediatric Research in Oslo. Our national soccer team, which had been very poor at that time, we got a new coach, and our soccer team kind of accelerated, and it was at the time ranked as number 2 in the world, which was incredible, because Norway had never had a good soccer team. So I said that if they're able to do that with soccer in Norway, we can do it also in research. So that was really inspiring me. And this coach, I had actually played against him when I was younger, so I knew him a little bit, and he was a very good player. So it's true. I think we can learn from sport, and we can learn from many other parts of society. And yeah, I'm very happy that because I have been dependent on having a big group around me. I have had 50 PhD fellows totally. And when my group was the biggest, I had 15 PhD fellows in the group. And it made us very efficient. We published a lot and people were enthusiastic. And I think people understood that we were kind of also working. We were pioneers in our field. So that was, of course, an advantage for us.
Yeah, I love that story about, you know, leadership and really teamwork being a key feature. But one of the other things I took from your answer about, you know, managing the complexity is that that collaboration is important. And actually, I mean, you were really a role model in international collaboration before it was so easy to just hop on a Zoom call, right? And do this extensive international collaboration. And I think we see that even now in neonatology, we've got amazing groups working on the same things across the globe. And I'm hoping you can give some guidance about how important collaboration across research teams and across, you know, international lines will help kind of move the field forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, coming from a small country, Norway, I very early in my career realized that I need to collaborate with foreign groups in order to achieve what I wanted to. So that was one important understanding. But then I think what is also very important is that some people are following the same track. Not only for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, but for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and to kind of know the history. And maybe also then it's easier to see where the future direction should go. And I have been privileged because I followed one idea from when I started research till today, basically. Follow one idea which I have developed.
My last question then is, you've really, like you said, seen the whole history of oxygen in neonatology as it stands. Where do we go from here? What are the holes still in the story for oxygen and our work in the NICU?
Well, yeah, we have still many unanswered questions. And it's, first of all, I think it's for the premies, especially the immature babies, less than 0.8 weeks. We don't know really what the optimal initial FiO2 is for these babies. And we have a lot of discussion about that. And what we know for sure that the most immature babies, they probably need some oxygen initially. We shouldn't start with air for these babies, but we don't know how much we should give them. And we have so far suggested that we should start with 30% oxygen and titrate according to the clinical development, heart rate, etc. But it might be that we need higher, to start higher. So this is one unanswered question. And the international group I'm a part of, we are working on this, but I don't think we have the final answer yet.
Dr. Sokstad, this was a great place for us to end on. It really a tremendous conversation. I've clipped so many things that you've said along this this interesting hour, and I think our audience will really enjoy listening to this conversation. Thank you so much for making the time to be on with us this morning, this evening for you, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for interesting questions and for this nice discussion and communication. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to The Incubator. If you like this episode, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or the Apple Podcast website. You can find other episodes of The Incubator and new shows from The Incubator Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcast, or the podcast app of your choice. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us questions, comments, or suggestions to our email address, nicupodcast@gmail.com or by visiting our website, www.the-incubator.org. You can also message the show on Instagram or X, formerly known as Twitter, @NICU Podcast. Thanks again for listening and see you next time. This podcast is intended to be purely for entertainment and informational purposes and should not be construed as medical advice. If you have any medical concerns, please see your primary care practitioner. Thank you.